Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
In 1865, the American showman P.T. Barnum had grown tired of his reputation of being the nation's most notorious liar. After 3 decades of hoodwinking the public with hoaxes both big and small, Barnum's name had become synonymous with deceit. In a way, it was a classic boy-who-cried-wolf scenario. After all, it wasn't like Barnum's reputation had come unearned. But despite that, it seemed to genuinely bother Barnum that people thought that he was a scam artist. He was actually a very religious man who was deeply involved in the progressive Universalist Church. It was important to him that people thought that he was moral. So being Barnum, he made a pitch. He was going to reinvent himself as a great debunker of scams and ripoffs. To that end, he wrote the book elaborately titled, The Humbugs of the World, An Account of Humbugs, Delusions, Impositions, Quackeries, Deceits, and Deceivers Generally in All Ages. His thesis was essentially that there's a difference between harmless humbug and full-on scam. The important ingredient for Barnum was the feeling of being ripped off. If someone tricks you, takes your money, and you get nothing in return, then that's immoral. But if someone tricks you into paying for something that turns out to be pretty cool, then it's all good. Barnum lays out his distinction using a few colorful descriptions. Quote, a respectable-looking man sits beside you in an omnibus or rail car. He converses fluently and is evidently a man of intelligence and reading. He attracts your attention by his fair pretenses. Arriving at your journey's end, you miss your watch and your pocketbook. Your fellow passenger proves to be the thief. Everyone calls him a pickpocket, and notwithstanding his fair pretenses, no one in the community calls him a humbug. End quote. A few paragraphs later, Barnum really spells it out, writing, quote, two physicians reside on one of our fashionable avenues. They were both educated in the best medical colleges. Each had passed an examination, received a diploma, and had been dubbed MD. They are both equally skilled in the healing art. One rides about quietly, visiting his patients without noise or clamor. The other sallies out, preceded by a band of music, and his carriage and horse are covered with handbills and placards, announcing his wonderful cures. This man is properly called a quack and a humbug. Why? Not because he cheats or imposes upon the public, for he does not, but because, as generally understood, humbug consists of putting on glittering appearances, outside show, novel expedients, by which to suddenly arrest public attention and attract the public eye and ear. End quote. This was Barnum's great plea to the court of public opinion. If he was a humbug, then he was going to prove that being a humbug wasn't so bad. He wasn't a liar and a cheat. He was just lovably tacky. And what could be more American than being lovably tacky? Barnum would have his readers believe that just like that quack doctor, he may put on glittering appearances, but he always delivered on his promise. And that promise was entertainment. But as we've already seen, despite Barnum's insistence that he was always a flawlessly moral person, his spectacles could often exist in ethical gray areas. After all, these hoaxes were not always victimless crimes. Also, in our own age, plagued by fake news, Barnum's media manipulations start to feel a little less benign. What's that old saying? Fake news is the first draft of fake history? In many ways, Barnum gave birth to our modern media age, where distraction and spectacle are everywhere, and facts are less important than, quote, glittering appearances. What we need to decide is if that's a good thing or a bad thing. This is our fake history. episode 33, Who is the Prince of Humbugs? Part 2. Hello, and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the show where we look at historical myths and try and figure out what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we wrap up our series on one of the most famous human beings to live in the 1800s, P.T. Barnum. How famous was P.T. Barnum? He was so famous that in the mid-19th century, admirers from as far abroad as Scotland and New Zealand only needed to write P.T. Barnum, America, on an envelope, and letters would be delivered to him. The mail carriers just knew where he lived. Now, if you haven't heard part one of this series, you may want to go back and listen to that now. In that first episode, I detailed Barnum's rise as a hoaxer. We looked at his troubling exhibition of the slave, Joyce Heth, and the more complicated ethical quandaries involved in exhibiting his other so-called human curiosities. We also took a tour of Barnum's American Museum, with the help of author Candace Fleming, whose popular book on Barnum was a key resource for that journey. But despite all the ground that we covered, we have yet to explore some of Barnum's most famous hoaxes, and his greatest legacy of all, the Barnum and Bailey Circus. Now, it's an interesting thing studying P.T. Barnum, because he was a man who was obsessed with public image. He always believed historians were going to pick over his life one day, and so you get the sense that he very carefully curated his own legacy. When Barnum was nearing the end of his life in March 1891, he actually requested that the New York Evening Sun print his obituary before he died so he could read it. I mean, that is pure Barnum. It speaks volumes about a man who was very worried about how he would be remembered. He didn't want people to remember him as a shady businessman and a liar. He wanted to go down as a great showman, philanthropist, and entertainer of the masses. And lucky for him, the obituary that he got to read a month before he passed away would say exactly that. But of course, Barnum's legacy is far more complicated than the Prince of Humbugs would have us believe. Despite his best efforts to curate his own history, time has a way of undoing even the most carefully constructed historical narratives. So let's dip back into the life of P.T. Barnum and explore a few more of his famous hoaxes, and hopefully get a stronger understanding of his slippery relationship with the truth. No examination of P.T. Barnum would be complete without one of his most famous humbugs, the so-called Fiji Mermaid. In 1842, just 1 year after the official opening of Barnum's American Museum, Barnum began displaying what he claimed to be the corpse of a mermaid that had originally been caught off the Pacific island of Fiji. To advertise this amazing object, Barnum created newspaper ads that featured drawings of bare-breasted, long-haired women with those distinctive fishtails. If taken at face value, the advertisements seemed to suggest that Barnum had the beautiful body of a female fish hybrid on display. When patrons paid their money to see the mermaid, what they got was something else entirely. The Fiji mermaid had actually begun its life in Japan, where a local fisherman had carefully stitched the preserved torso of a monkey to the tail of a large fish. These taxidermy hybrids had actually been around for some time. In Japan and the Philippines and other parts of the Pacific, these mammal fish creations had been a type of folk art for generations. According to historian Stephen Levy, the Japanese fisherman who first created it actually used it for a Barnum-like stunt of his own in his home village. The man, whose name has been lost to history, claimed that the mermaid was an omen of a plague of sterility that was about to sweep the region. The only way to guard against the sterility was to buy yourself a picture, probably an illustration, of the mermaid. So from its very beginning, the object was straight humbug. The mermaid was eventually sold to an American seaman named Samuel Barrett Eads, who actually had to embezzle money from his ship's expense account to pay the somewhat unbelievable price of $6,000 for the object. Eads did his best to make his money back by displaying the object at his various ports of call, but he found little success. He was eventually sued by his shipping company because of his embezzlement, and when he died, all he left his heirs was a boatload of debts and this weird monkey fish. Eads' son, wanting to be rid of the cursed object and recoup some cash, would eventually sell it to one Moses Kimball. Kimball ran a museum in Boston, and as soon as he laid eyes on the strange object, he knew there was only one man who could make this ugly thing profitable, and that man was P.T. Barnum. You see, both Barnum and Kimball knew that on its own, the object was not a guaranteed moneymaker. After all, old Captain Eads never did make back his $6,000. It was going to take Barnum's unique ability to play the media and excite the public to bring in the cash. So Barnum hatched a plan. Now, by this point in his life, Barnum understood that his name was synonymous with deceit. So for people to really believe that the Fiji mermaid was real, Barnum's name needed to stay away from it until the last possible moment. So he devised a strategy to plant the story of the mermaid in the news months ahead of its display in New York. Barnum had his lawyer and regular co-conspirator, Levi Lyman, pose as one Dr. Griffin of the Lyceum of Natural History in London. Barnum then had friends in Alabama, South Carolina, and Washington, D.C. send letters to the New York newspapers claiming that they had met this Dr. Griffin and mentioning, oh so casually, that he had a mermaid in his possession. This started to get interest percolating in the press. Who were these random people sending us letters about mermaids? Who was this mysterious doctor? Then Barnum had Levi Lyman travel to Philadelphia with the Fiji mermaid. He had him check into one of the city's fanciest hotels as Dr. Griffin. The good Dr. Griffin then managed to meet the hotel's owner and ask the man if he wanted to see his incredible mermaid. The man obviously agreed, and he took a peek at the object. Just as Barnum planned, the gullible hotel owner then quickly blabbed to the Philadelphia press that he had seen a mermaid. The New York papers quickly followed the lead of the Philly press and were announcing that a real-life mermaid had been spotted in the city of brotherly love. Just when the media frenzy was at its height, Barnum started flooding the streets of New York with anonymously produced mermaid pamphlets. He then started doing interviews with local papers, saying that he was desperately trying to contact Dr. Griffin to get permission to display the mermaid in his museum. And then, right on cue, Dr. Griffin, aka Levi Lyman, graciously agreed to take Barnum up on his offer. It was announced that the Fiji mermaid would be displayed at the American Museum for the curious public to come and see for themselves. It was a classic two-man confidence grift. When people paid their money and saw a small, grotesque fish monkey, many came away crying humbug once again, but by that point, Barnum had already gotten their cash. Nonetheless, there were many who, even after seeing the Fiji mermaid, were still convinced of its veracity. People actually started publicly debating whether or not the Fiji mermaid was real, which only delighted Barnum, who saw it as just more free publicity. In 1843, he took the show on the road, and in Charleston, South Carolina, the mermaid nearly caused a duel between a local amateur naturalist and a journalist from the local paper. The paper had written a glowing editorial declaring the Fiji mermaid to be the genuine article. The naturalist was so disgusted that his local paper was taken in by such an obvious fake that he publicly denounced the author of the article. Apparently, friends of the two men had to intervene before their argument escalated into a gunfight. After about a year and a half on display, the novelty of the Fiji mermaid had thoroughly worn off. By that time, most people had decided that it was a hoax, and Barnum himself would eventually admit as much in his autobiography published in 1855. After the mermaid had served its purpose, it was quietly filed away in a box, only occasionally being brought back out by Moses Kimball for the odd display here and there. The Fiji mermaid is a great example of how Barnum could manipulate the media and create a story where there previously was not one. But he was also equally adept at taking real stories in the news and spinning them to promote one of his new museum attractions. Perhaps the most famous example of this was the Woolly Horse hoax of 1849. A year earlier, Barnum had bought a horse with unusually long hair from a man in Cincinnati. It was from a breed of horses known as Curlies, who were known for their long fur. Apparently, this particular specimen was especially furry-looking. But on its own, it wasn't a very exciting attraction. It was just a horse. But Barnum knew that it wasn't about the exhibit. It was about the story. And at that particular moment, there was no story being followed more closely by the American public than that of Colonel John C. Fremont. Fremont was an American Army officer who had taken a small band of explorers into the Rocky Mountains with the goal of surveying a possible railway route from the Rio Grande River to California. In the winter of 1849, Colonel Fremont and his company disappeared. They had become lost somewhere in the heights of the Rocky Mountains, and as the winter cold settled in, many worried that the company was doomed. The newspapers followed this story very closely, reporting daily on any new information about the fate of the Fremont expedition. Eventually, the American public sighed a long breath of relief when Fremont was discovered alive. He had lost 10 men during the expedition and had led what remained of his company to Taos, New Mexico. And it was a media sensation, which kind of reminds me of the whole Chilean miners thing that happened a few years back. P.T. Barnum saw that the American public were hungry for all things Fremont. So, this might just be an opportunity for the Woolly Horse. He concocted a story that Fremont and his company had actually captured the animal during their storied expedition, and naturalists had confirmed that it was a completely unique species. He ran this ad in the New York papers that read, quote, "Colonel Fremont's nondescript or woolly horse will be exhibited for a few days at the corner of Broadway and Reed Street, previous to his departure for London. Nature seems to have exerted all her ingenuity in the production of this astounding animal. He is extremely complex, made up of the elephant, deer, horse, buffalo, camel, and sheep. It is the full size of a horse, has the haunches of a deer, the tail of an elephant, a fine curled wool of camel's hair, and easily bounds 12 or 15 feet high. Naturalists and the oldest trappers assured Colonel Fremont that it was never known previous to his discovery. It is undoubtedly nature's last and the richest specimen received from California. To be seen every day this week, admittance 25 cents. Children half price." End quote. Now, this particular hoax actually got Barnum into some trouble. It was one thing to humbug the public, but it was quite another to put someone else's good name on the line in service of your scam. It wasn't long before members of the Fremont family started making noise about having their famous relative's name associated with one of Barnum's money-making stunts. Eventually, Fremont's father-in-law came forward and loudly decried the Woolly Horse as a fraud. He said in no uncertain terms that Colonel Fremont had never laid eyes on Barnum's animal, and that the whole thing was a cheap scam designed to use his son-in-law's famous name to shake down the American public one quarter at a time. For a little while, Barnum continued to display the horse. As usual, ticket sales were buoyed by the controversy. But it wasn't too long after this public shaming that Barnum had the horse shipped back to his home in Connecticut. In the case of both the Fiji Mermaid and the Woolly Horse, what we see is that Barnum understood that a good exhibit wasn't about having a good display. It was about having a good story. Barnum's immense fame in the mid-19th century might suggest that his life was just a series of unmitigated successes, but this really was not the case. Barnum may have had a unique talent for making money, but he wasn't particularly good at keeping it. He was flashy and had no qualms with throwing money at vanity projects, the best example of this being the grandiose mansion he built for himself in Bridgeport, Connecticut, that he nicknamed Iranistan. The building was so named because of the Middle Eastern and Indian influence in the architecture. The design had been inspired by George IV's pavilion in Brighton, England, which itself had been inspired by the architecture that he had seen in India. Iranistan was completely over the top, and Barnum himself barely lived there. Instead, he preferred his swanky Fifth Avenue home in Manhattan. Barnum was also forever getting caught up in bad investments. After his initial success with Joyce Heth, he lost almost all of his money playing the stock market at a particularly volatile time. In the 1850s, he would ruin himself again financially after investing in a failing clockmaking business. Barnum had hoped that this business would move a factory to a model town he was trying to set up. The whole idea was kind of ill-conceived, and before long, Barnum had ruined himself while trying to save this clock company. Along the way, Barnum would also be plagued by fire. In 1857, at the height of his financial woes, Barnum's Iranistan would burn to the ground. Then, less than a decade later, a fire swept through Barnum's American Museum, destroying all the exhibits he had spent a lifetime collecting and killing dozens of animals in the zoo. Undeterred, Barnum pulled up his socks and opened a new American Museum, but it only lasted 3 years before it too burnt to the ground. Some of these disasters Barnum brought on himself, and others were just plain bad luck. But whatever you think of P.T. Barnum, one thing that was true about him is that he was resilient. No matter how dire his situation seemed, the guy never lost his hustle. When he seemed down and out, he just got back on the road. He was saved more than once by one of his most successful performers, the 19th century's most famous little person, General Tom Thumb. Tom Thumb was actually named Charles Stratton and had originally been exhibited by Barnum in the 1840s, when Stratton was just 4 years old. The boy's act had basically been a comedy routine, where he played the funny man and Barnum, or sometimes a paid actor, played the straight man. They had toured Europe together and had even performed for Queen Victoria, who went so far as to invite Barnum and Tom Thumb to eat dinner with her. When Barnum fell on hard times, it was Tom Thumb who came to the rescue. He was one of the first to reach out to Barnum, and he suggested that they head back to Europe and put the old show back on. Sure enough, it was a success, and Barnum was saved. Barnum also had the audacity to write a book about money-making right at the pinnacle of his financial calamities, called The Art of Money Getting, which, by the way, is an amazing title. The book also doubled as a promotion for a speaking tour where Barnum would lecture on the finer points of making cash. Even he seems to have appreciated the irony of this and even joked to a friend that he was actually more a master of the art of money losing. Nevertheless, every time Barnum was down, he managed to make a comeback. After getting back on his feet, Barnum even went into politics for a period of time. And interestingly enough, he was actually a rather progressive politician for his day. He was elected to the Connecticut State Legislature in 1865, where he vocally advocated for the voting rights of African Americans in his state. Now, this is part of what makes Barnum so complicated. As we explored in the last episode, he was someone that owned a slave and profited off of her exhibition. But by the time we get to the mid-1860s, he seems to have evolved considerably when it comes to his understanding of race. He made impassioned speeches about the innate rights of all people. In other words, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy that would condone the actions of his younger self. Those looking for proof that Barnum was a good person often point to his tenure as a state senator. And to be fair, his positions were deeply unpopular, which only serves to confirm the fact that he really believed in them. Only in mid-century America could someone go from slave owner to advocate for Black Americans in one lifetime. I don't know what to tell you. People are complicated. But Barnum's final and most lasting reinvention was as the king of the traveling circus. In 1870, at the ripe age of 60 years old, Barnum created his first traveling show, somewhat clumsily named P.T. Barnum's Grand Traveling Museum, Menagerie, Caravan, and Hippodrome. By 1881, Barnum had merged his show with the other great circus impresario of the age, James Bailey. The result was the Barnum and Bailey Circus, a.k.a. the greatest show on earth. The circus was everything you would expect. Acrobats, clowns, exotic animals, and of course, human curiosities. But because this is Barnum, it had to be bigger and better. Barnum had noticed that the typical ring circus was a bit of a crowd control nightmare. People often fought and clamored for the good seats, leaving children and the less violently inclined to settle for bad views. So Barnum decided to change the format. He started by adding a second ring so two acts could be performed simultaneously and the good seats could be doubled. It wasn't long before Barnum's two-ring circus was being copied by every act in the nation. So, of course, Barnum felt the need to outdo his competitors yet again by introducing the first ever three-ring circus. The result was a sensory overload of entertainment. Now there were no bad seats. Barnum wanted to create an effect where every direction you looked, something incredible was happening. Eventually, even the term three-ring circus would become shorthand for anything wild, chaotic, and thrilling. But perhaps the greatest attraction to grace Barnum and Bailey's three rings was Jumbo, history's most famous African elephant. Jumbo was captured as a baby in the Sudan and eventually made his way to the zoo in Paris. He was then traded to the London Zoo because the French zookeepers thought that he was too small to be a good attraction. This would prove ironic because in London, Jumbo would grow to become the biggest African elephant in captivity. But beyond his impressive size, Jumbo delighted crowds because he had such an identifiable personality. He was playful and seemed to have a sense of humor. Elephants are incredibly intelligent animals who demonstrate complicated social relationships in the wild, and Jumbo was no different. Long before Barnum got his hands on him, Jumbo was the pride of London. Even Winston Churchill would fondly remember going to the zoo as a child and seeing the amazing Jumbo. When Barnum and Bailey Circus bought Jumbo from the London Zoo in 1881, apparently some 10,000 British schoolchildren wrote Queen Victoria begging her not to let Jumbo go to America. As it would turn out, Britain's children were not the only ones who didn't want the elephant to leave England. Jumbo himself didn't seem too keen on the idea. The day he was scheduled to leave London, he was being led from his enclosure when he suddenly trumpeted out a mighty bellow and then flung himself down on the pavement, refusing to move. No matter what the elephant's handlers did, Jumbo would not go anywhere. Barnum's manager cabled him the news about Jumbo's stubbornness, but the showman was delighted by this. This was good publicity. Barnum told his men in London to just let Jumbo lay there. The longer he laid down, the more the press would write about it, and the more excited people would be once he finally got to America. And once again, Barnum was right. The daily reports on Jumbo's refusal to move sparked a bit of a Jumbo mania in the States. A small cottage industry of Jumbo knickknacks even started to grow as anticipation mounted. Eventually, after 8 days, Jumbo gave up his protest and got into his specially made crate to be shipped to the United States. Now, despite the fond memories that many people had of Jumbo, that poor elephant did not live a good life. One of the only ways his handlers could keep him in check was to give him huge quantities of alcohol. He was known to drink full kegs of beer, full bottles of wine, and champagne. Apparently, his favorite snacks were large whiskey-soaked biscuits. You heard it here first. Jumbo was a bit of a lush. All jokes aside, though, you can't help but feel bad for the guy. Jumbo did have tusks, but he anxiously wore them down to a fraction of their regular size by grinding them against his enclosure every night. But the greatest Jumbo myth, and perhaps the most tragic, has to do with his death. And amazingly, there is a Canadian connection to this story. You see, the story of Jumbo's death is not mine to tell. It's a story that belongs to the good people of St. Thomas, Ontario. It just so happens that one of my old friends, Megan Morgan, is a native daughter of St. Thomas and a former tour guide around the Jumbo Monument. I truly believe that the only way to properly tell this story is to let a proud local of St. Thomas spin the yarn. So let's take a listen to my conversation with Megan. So Megan, thanks for being the first ever guest on Our Fake History. So what do you know about Jumbo?
Well, having been born and raised in St. Thomas and then eventually getting a job as a St. Thomas and Elgin County tourism officer, I know enough about Jumbo that I feel comfortable saying that I know more than most people.
Fair enough. You are a firsthand witness of the Jumbo myth. Fill us in. Fill us in. What is the Jumbo myth?
The Jumbo myth, it's ubiquitous amongst pretty much all people born and raised in St. Thomas. There are drastically different stories. There's the one, as a tourism officer, I even perpetuated it, mostly to children because I didn't want to tell them the gory details.
Okay.
And that tends to be the one that most people know.
Okay. So what is the cleaned up, safe for kids, like Jumbo died heroically story?
Okay. So The thing that you need to know first is that St. Thomas was the railway capital of Canada at the time of this story. Pretty much all freight trains came through St. Thomas at this point. It was a major hub of activity. There was a lot of comings and goings. And at the time, like, Barnum Circus was not actually performing in town. They were just stopped for a little bit. So they got the animals out of the train so that they could exercise them. And then all of a sudden, this unscheduled freight train starts coming down the tracks and they have very little time to get out of the way. And Jumbo sees this little baby elephant, Tom Thumb, stuck in the middle of the tracks. So he runs as fast as he can, knocks the baby elephant out of the way, and then gets hit by the train, dying heroically as the savior of poor Tom Thumb.
I've also heard that in his dying moments, Jumbo reached out his trunk and put it around his crying trainer's shoulders as if to say, "Goodbye, my friend." Is that, have you ever heard that little tidbit as well?
I have heard that. I've also heard that he reached out and like held his hand with his trunk, which just seems like it's one of those stories that's so obviously from P.T. Barnum, right, that it's very distinctive. I very much doubt that happened, for reasons I'll get into later. But I feel like it's very possible that his trainer like reached out and grabbed his trunk and people saw that happen. So I think there was some contact between his trainer and him, but it was not the way that
it was
described.
There could have been a kernel of truth in that one.
A kernel, but like I very much doubt that that actually happened.
Okay. So what's the true story? What is the truth of the death of Jumbo?
The truth is that he was probably dead when the train hit him.
Oh, okay, explain.
Okay, so Jumbo is an African Saharan elephant. I mean, he came from Sudan. He's used to very level ground. These elephants are not really known for being able to traverse rocky terrain. And all of a sudden, he's in this area where there's lots of train tracks, and he's being forced to run. And he's kind of boxed in with an escarpment on one side, and there was another set of tracks with some train cars on it. So he didn't really have a lot of room to maneuver. So he's trying to get around, and he's running on train tracks, and he tripped. And he fell on his face.
Okay.
He fell on his face, and his tusk got lodged in his brain.
So, did the train even hit him?
It did hit him, because, I mean, there was a dead elephant on the tracks. I couldn't really miss him.
So the truth about Jumbo is he got out of a train, tripped on some tracks, died instantly, and then a train hit an elephant corpse.
Yes.
I can understand why they created a myth, because otherwise that is just a sad end to perhaps the 19th century's most famous animal.
No, it's true. But I mean, the fact that so many people still remember him, and even if it's through the myth, I mean, I think that's still pretty cool.
Yeah. So like, what does this story mean to St. Thomas, Ontario?
So much. I mean, we have that giant monument that's supposed to be the life size of Jumbo, which, I mean, is kind of also in dispute, a little bit of a myth itself. So, you know, like, it's part of our identity. We have a local brewery that puts out a beer called Dead Elephant. I mean, it's ingrained in us from a very young age that this is a point of pride.
I love that the first Canadian connection I've been able to make in this show has to do with the death of Jumbo and like small town Ontario's pride in killing P.T. Barnum's famed elephant. It's the best thing that's ever happened, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the pride that gets me. I mean, I remember when in the infancy of Facebook, when Facebook's like first became a thing for everyone, not just like in certain universities, I created a group called My Hometown Killed an Elephant, and I got like 3,000 followers on that page.
Yeah.
Like St. Thomas is Jumbo crazy.
All right, Megan, thanks again for being the first ever guest on Our Fake History. And here's a shout out to St. Thomas, Ontario.
Oh, for sure. And please go visit the Jumbo Monument. I know that there's people who work there from like May 24 to Labor Day who are just bored out of their minds. So yeah, visit St. Thomas any chance you get.
Right on. All right. Thanks again. So, as Megan just explained to us, P.T. Barnum would create quite the myth about Jumbo's death. He would also put on a public show of grieving for his dead elephant. But in reality, he was about as torn up about Jumbo's death as he had been about Joyce Heth's. He quickly sent a team of taxidermists up to Canada to both preserve Jumbo's skeleton and his hide. The hide was stuffed and stretched over a large wooden frame, and the skeleton was pieced back together. Then Barnum started displaying the two as the, and you're not going to believe this, the double Jumbo. So now when you came to the circus, you didn't see Jumbo once, you saw him twice. Once as a skeleton and once as a giant stuffy. Just like in the Joyce Heth case, Barnum once again realized that death wasn't necessarily bad for business. But death would eventually come for Barnum as well. After suffering a stroke in early 1891, he finally passed away in April of that year. As he would learn when reading his own obituary a month before he died, he had been largely successful in rehabilitating his reputation and securing his legacy in the final years of his life. They focused less on the hoaxes that made him the Prince of Humbugs and more on the family-friendly entertainments that had delighted a generation. Historians have been a bit more divided when it comes to assessing Barnum's legacy. Historian Arthur Saxon and author Candace Fleming generally present Barnum as a lovable, if flawed, practical joker. They seem comfortable with Barnum's own assurances that his lies were never meant to hurt, and his humbugs always served to delight. But other historians, like Benjamin Rice, are far less forgiving of Barnum's transgressions. After all, Barnum's main motivation had always been the accumulation of profit, and he was often willing to violate the values that he paid lip service to in order to make those profits. In Rice's view, Barnum often downplayed the more morally dubious moments in his life story, just in the same way that he exaggerated his great triumphs. So, a critical reader must handle him with care. Just like many of the figures we've covered on Our Fake History, be it Napoleon or Ty Cobb, P.T. Barnum doesn't neatly fit into the category of hero or villain. But perhaps, the deeper you look at history, the less those categories even make sense. So how do you sum up a life like P.T. Barnum's? Well, I've been spending quite a lot of time with the old showman, and so I've developed a bit of a theory, so bear with me. I've come to believe that he is perhaps one of the most quintessentially American people to ever live. Now, let me explain what I mean by this. You see, many people have joked that we Canadians are kind of the world's experts on Americans. We share so much of American culture that we understand it like insiders, but we're still able to stand outside of it and look at it from a critical distance. Being a Canadian is the closest thing to being an American without actually being an American. And I think that gives us a unique perspective on their culture. So, from where I stand, I think there's one thing that the United States of America does better than any other country in the world. And that thing is spectacle. Absolutely no one on earth puts on a show like the good old US of A. From the Super Bowl to Disneyland to the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade to television events to the entire city of Las Vegas, not to mention every Hollywood movie ever made, America has perfected the art of spectacle. American entertainment continues to be that country's most resilient industry and most sought-after export. It simply cannot be outsourced. Showmanship is just a part of American culture in a way that it isn't in Canada, or any other country for that matter. And P.T. Barnum pretty much invented it. Barnum showed America that there's nothing wrong with being shameless. And in fact, being shameless can really help put a show over the top. He showed his countrymen that they shouldn't shy away from being grandiose. When I say that Barnum is the most American person, I don't mean that he was the best American person or the most admirable American person. I mean that he was the most indicative of that big, brassy American character. P.T. Barnum is the most American person to ever live because he did the most to shape American entertainment, which has become an inextricable part of American culture. For better or worse, Barnum is America. Okay, that's all for this week. Thanks again for listening. Before we go, I'd like to take a minute to thank everyone that's been supporting the Patreon campaign. The generosity has been very humbling. I am so amazed that you guys have been giving at the rates that you have been. So thank you so much. The Patreon campaign is the number one way that this podcast continues. So thank you so much. Specifically, I'd like to give shout outs to Tony Johnson Jonsfesky, Dharmit Joshi, Mela Eckenfels, Stephen Protasewicz, and Patricia Mills. All of you guys supported at the $5 or more level, and that makes you the ultimate champions. Thank you so much. I can't say thank you enough. It's really amazing what's been going on at the Patreon page. So for all of you out there who are supporting on Patreon at $3 or more, I've got some good news. I've got a little gift for you just in time for the holidays. So if you head to your Patreon page or check out your Patreon feed, you will see that there is a new extra episode. It is the Our Fake History Lost episode. Yes, back when I was first conceiving of the podcast, I created a prototype episode where I laid out my philosophy of the podcast and told kind of a crazy story. I chose not to use it in the end, not because it wasn't good, but just because I thought people didn't want to hear a whole episode about my idea for the podcast. I thought, just do the podcast. Well, I figured you on Patreon might like that glimpse behind the curtain and might be interested in what the first ever Our Fake History episode was supposed to sound like. So all of you at the $3 or more level now have that. It's not for sale anywhere else. You will not be able to buy it from the extras episode section on the website. It's only for Patreon subscribers. So go check out the lost episode of Our Fake History. Also, before we go this week, I wanted to let you know about the upcoming release schedule of Our Fake History. So, like many of you, I have a bonkers bananas holiday season coming up. I'm driving all over this great province of ours here in Ontario. So, basically, it means that you are not going to get another Our Fake History until January 9th. So, it's not a 2-week wait, it's a 4-week wait. But we will be back on January 9th. So, don't unsubscribe on me. Stick around. I guarantee you we will be back. Also, that gives me more time to read up on some new topics, to create some new things, and to make sure that podcast keeps coming at the quality that it's been coming so far. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can go to the Facebook page and check out all the stuff I'm going to have posted there. I'm going to have pictures from this last show, maybe a picture of a woolly horse, maybe a little Fiji mermaid. That's at Facebook/ourfakehistory. Or you can go to Twitter and follow along there at ourfakehistory. As always, I encourage you to rate and review the show on iTunes or any other podcast app that lets you rate the show. The ratings just help people find us. So think about rating or reviewing the show. As always, the theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music on the show was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.